From the studios of Radio Sai at Prashanthi Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And in today's segment, we are going to listen to a talk by Brother Prem. Prem needs no introduction to the Radio Sai listeners. This is once again from the series of talks that were delivered in the Satsang Hall. So over to Brother Prem.
Offering the most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. I pray to Swami that He gives us all the understanding, that He alone is the one who speaks. He alone is the one who listens through all of us. Elders, brothers and sisters, Sairam to all of you. In the Brindavan hostel, Swami's campus of the university, there is one person who has been working almost from the time the hostel was set up. He was working even when I was a student, which was at least 30 years after the establishment of the campus. This person, his name was Ramayya. And he happened to be one of the sweepers in the campus. And every day, even as I was a student, I remember him sweeping our corridors, keeping the kitchen clean, keeping the dining hall clean. So one of the many, the low-grade workers in the hostel. So one day he came up to the warden and he said, "Sir, I have arranged for my daughter's wedding. So I want to give an invitation card to Swami and seek Swami's blessings." The warden told him that there is no way I can take your invitation card and give it on behalf of you. There is no way I can tell Swami that here is somebody who wants your blessings. So he said, "Swami is in Vrindavan. Swami is going to come out for darshan. So you make your prayer and try to offer the card yourself." So the warden said, "There is one thing in my power. I will give you a place of prominence." Right? Even now, if you see in Vrindavan, there is the hostel and there is the Kalyan Mandapam. And you would see that the hostel's corners are marked by these elephant sculptures, right? These three corners. We used to call it the elephant corner. So the warden told him, "You stand at that corner. So when Swami comes out to go to darshan, you, your wife and your daughter can stand there and Swami will see that somebody is standing there. So Swami might call you and speak to you. Otherwise, when Swami is coming out for darshan, when he is closer to that area, he might look at you and say, 'Who is this?' Call you and speak to you." So he said, "I can do that much. I'll give you a place of prominence. You stand there." So this man said, "All right." He stood there with his family and with his invitation in his hand. And promptly, probably sometime around 8 o'clock, Swami comes out for darshan. And even as Swami is entering the Ramesh Hall, Swami looks at this man, but then turns away and goes off for darshan. So this man is disappointed, but nevertheless he waits. Swami comes for darshan, finishes darshan, does not look at him. And as Swami is going back into his residence, again from Ramesh Hall to Thrai, again Swami looks at him, stares at him, turns and goes away. So now this man is heartbroken. So he waits, the warden comes back, he runs to the warden and starts crying. He said, "Sir, Swami saw me, but Swami did not call me. Swami did not bless my daughter's wedding." So the warden told him, "Don't worry, Swami has gone in for an interview. Mostly after an interview, Swami goes out for a drive. So you stand in the same place, there are chances that Swami might drive by, stop and bless you." He had actually lost all his hopes, but he said, "All right, the last chance," he went and stood there. The interviews got over, but he didn't see the car coming to pick up Swami. But nevertheless, he saw the doors being opened, the gates were opened. And even as he was seeing, he saw Swami was himself walking and coming. This man was surprised, but Swami came straight to him. There was nobody else there. Swami came straight to him and Swami said, "Bangaru, are you feeling bad that I didn't bless you? Don't feel bad." Swami said, "Today, what day is it today?" Swami said, "Today is a Monday. And on Mondays, 7:30 to 9 is Rahu Kalam. How can I bless your daughter's wedding on a Rahu Kalam?" So Swami said, "I was waiting for 9 o'clock. See, now the time is 9 o'clock. Swami accepted the invitation, blessed the daughter, gave her a silk sari, blessed them profusely. It's a beautiful incident. Of course, it shows Swami's love, because even as we used to be told this incident, this happened probably 10 years before I was a student, when we used to be told this incident of Swami's love, around the same time, Swami was visited by Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Right? He went on to become the Prime Minister of India. And in my times, I've seen so many celebrities come and go, so many being ignored. So in Swami's scheme of things, even if you look at him as an administrative head, he was the chancellor, this was one of the many campuses that he had, and in that one of the many campuses, this was one worker which was there. But not only was blessing him important to Swami, but blessing him in an appropriate time was important to Swami. Only somebody who is interested in you will think like that. Otherwise, they will just get the work done, right? Yeah, just give him a sari, just bless, give him some money. But Swami wanted to bless, and Swami wanted to bless in the most appropriate manner too. Fine, that's the beauty of the incident. But in the Indian scriptures, God is described as Kala Kalaya Namaha, Kala Garbhaya Namaha, Kala Atitaya Namaha. We have heard this Swami saying this in discourses. There are more than this, but I don't know all of them, but all of it suggests that God is beyond time. Kala Kalaya Namaha. God is the one who is the master of time, who can be death to time itself. Kala Kalaya Namaha. Kala Garbhaya Namaha. God is the one in whose womb time exists. And Kala Atitaya Namaha, one who is beyond time. And such a Lord comes and says, it's Rahu Kalam, how can I bless? It's an inauspicious time, how can I come and give my benediction? When the Lord is beyond time, why is He restricting Himself to such time? But if you consider that Swami is within this time and then you think that probably everything has to be like this, there are many times office bearers will tell you, when Swami will tell, start the program at this time, and if they happen to say, Swami, the Rahu Kalam starts at that time, Swami will give them a glare. You think I am not beyond Rahu Kalam? You think my blessings has to be confined to auspicious and inauspicious time? But nevertheless, he followed it. When we were students, we knew Swami's travel pattern would depend on whether it's an Ashtami or a Navami. We knew Swami's travel will depend on Tuesday, Swami won't travel. And Swami would have all of these strict restrictions that he accepted on himself. Probably one of the reasons was so that we will stop, look at this, definitely embrace all of these rituals to a small extent, like all of us have done, to a great extent. But also question, why is Swami allowing himself to be restricted by these kind of rituals and ritualistic understandings? When he is the Lord who is beyond all of this, why did he accept on himself these things? Probably so that one day we will stop and ask this question and try to go deep within. And one such observation which Swami used to give a lot of importance to was a festival that we celebrated a week ago. Same time this day, or probably on Saturday, Sunday, the festival of Sankranti. Among the many festivals in the Indian calendar, Swami gives importance to a few, and among the few, Sankranti was one of them. And among the few that Swami gives importance, Sankranti was definitely special in more ways than one. Many times when Swami would appoint some of his students in places in the ashram, when we had all finished our studies, we used to wait for Swami to give us a job. Many times, not once, twice, it was almost a pattern. When Swami gives a job to a person, Swami would give him the job, but Swami will tell him, don't join right now. Swami would say, wait till Uttarayanam. Uttarayanam is the period which begins with the Sankranti festival. Right? So Swami gave so much importance to this Sankranti and this Uttarayanam. And Swami would tell the most classic story from the Mahabharata, where you had this great warrior Bhishma, great warrior as well as a very saintly person, who had this boon called Ichha Mrityu. Means he had the will to decide when he will die. That was a boon given to him. And the story goes, the evil forces of the Kauravas were trying to defend themselves with this boon. They thought, here is Bhishma, he is going to be our warrior in chief. And he can never be killed unless he decides to be killed. So when he is there in the forefront of our army, we are impregnable. Nobody can defeat us. But the beautiful account goes that finally in the battlefield, through the, should we say, mischief or the intelligence or the intellect of Lord Krishna, Bhishma is literally incapacitated. He is still alive, but he cannot participate in the war. Barrage of arrows are showered at him and he's finally laid on this bed of arrows. But still he has this Ichcha Mrityu, or this boon to decide when he will die. And Swami would say that he held his life. He held his life till the point of Uttarayana. He waited for the Uttarayana to give up his body, and he was in immense pain throughout this period. Imagine having hundreds of arrows shot through you. And you choose to live because you want to depart at the time of Uttarayana. So what made these festivals special? What are these festivals? What do they stand for? So what I'll try to do today is probably start with, why did the Indian subcontinent celebrate these festivals? What do they physically demarcate? What do they physically represent? And then, like all other festivals, as Swami would say, you have to go into the spirit. If you do only what is to be done, it's a ritual. If you go into the spirit, then it becomes spiritual. So why this ritual? What was Sankranti celebrated for? The most direct explanation for that is that Sankranti is the celebration of the harvest season. Even today, India has progressed industrially, in the IT industry and all of that, but still we are an agrarian society. We are a society which depends a lot on agriculture, and it's quite understandable in the past it would have been even more than now. So all celebrations and all worships, all deities had connection to this profession of agriculture. So Sankranti is a celebration of the harvest season, directly put, right? It's celebrated in the north in different names, but all of it finally comes to the farmer is labored all through the year, and at the end of it, he is celebrating his produce and he's thanking the gods and the deities for giving him the bountiful. What is the Uttarayana? It's a very simple phenomenon. It's an astronomical phenomenon. The meaning of the word Uttarayana means the northward journey. Uttara means north. Ayana means to journey. So Uttarayana means the northward journey, right? So what is the phenomenon which is being represented here? The sun is traveling northwards. We all know the sun never travels. It's the earth which goes around the sun. But we all know this phenomenon of the seasons, right? Where it appears the sun is moving northwards and the sun is going southwards. Actually, it demarcates the seasons. And we know these two important events of the winter solstice and the summer solstice. Where at winter solstice, after that point, the day starts becoming longer. Right? From that point, the day starts becoming longer, suggesting the move towards the summer season. And Uttarayana is nothing but that. And talking of Sankranti, we all know the 12 zodiac signs. So each month is represented by which zodiac the sun is in, according to the Indian calendar. Sankranti is also called Makara Sankranti, where Makara is the sign of Capricorn. So when the sun moves into the sign of Capricorn, the zodiac sign of Capricorn, it's called Makara Sankranti. So what's the big deal? It's another festival, right? What is so great about this that Swami said, let's begin something auspicious on Uttarayana. Bhishma said, let's die on Uttarayana. What makes this special? Well, to understand that, we'll have to go into a little bit of history of humanity itself. And there is a beautiful discourse that Swami has given. If you have the opportunity, you all should go and read it. It's part of the 1991 Summer Course series, where Swami traces the history of mankind, how man began worshipping, how man started wondering about nature and the powers behind nature, and then started worshipping God, gave God a form, then went beyond the form, and for what reasons he retained the form, Swami gives a very beautiful and historical account of the relationship between man, nature and God. So in that discourse, Swami explains, man is suddenly born on this earth. What are the things that he looks around and he sees? Darkness and light, right? There is sunrise, there is sunset. There is day, there is night. And this is a pattern which comes again and again and again. And what does he also see? That as day comes and night, day is followed by night, night is followed by day, changes start occurring in his body. It's called aging. So there is a concept of passage of time which is marked by the movement of the sun. That is one thing that he observes. The other thing that he observes is the faces of the moon. And he realizes there is a pattern to it. Every fortnight, the moon is growing and then it's going down. It's growing and it's going down. So probably he gave it some story. Some demon is eating up the moon. And the moon is again regaining its glory or whatever. Whatever is the story that could pass on this idea of the moon diminishing and then growing back. So this idea of time based on day and night and this changing faces of the moon. So that was very interesting for him. And then he also realized the pattern of seasons. He realized and he observed this northward movement of the sun and the southward movement of the sun. And this is what was referred to as Uttarayana, going northward, and Dakshinayana, coming southward. And what Swami said was, you know, here is this primitive man who has nothing, no knowledge, no text to refer to, no Wikipedia or Google to go to. So all that he is doing is, he is seeing all these phenomena happening around him and he is observing himself. What are the changes that are happening inside? What are the changes that are happening outside? So one thing that he observes is, very simple thing, we take it for granted, in the morning you can see better. Right? We take it for granted. But he says, in the morning, I see things clearly. But at night, I need to be careful. A simple observation that he makes. And immediately attached to this observation is a certain reverence to this entity called the sun. The sun is enabling me to see. Because of the light of the sun, I am able to see where there is a ditch, where there is, you know, a mound. This sun is enabling me to see better. So there is a certain reverence for the sun. See the beautiful connection that he is making here. What makes us decide between A and B, right and wrong? Should I take this path or that path? We call it discrimination, right? It's called buddhi. And what enables this buddhi to function? If I'm able to see better, right? I should be able to see better. So he draws a beautiful connection between his ability to see, his ability to discriminate, and the light of the sun. And he has reverence for this sun. And Swami says, when he looks up in the sky, there are so many stars, there are so many thousands of stars, but there is one sun there, illuminating the whole sky. So automatically that, oh, here is that great one. Right? All civilizations speak of this reverence to the sun, because this sun seems to be the ruler of the sky. So this was one observation that he made. The other observation that he makes is, the moon is also shining, right? The moon also shines. The moon also seems to have light, but this light cannot be trusted. That is the classic analogy they give in Vedanta, right? Man is going, he sees a rope, he's not sure whether it's a snake or a rope. And then there is fear, then there is worry, then he is thinking. Why is it? Swami says, because it's twilight. Or it is night time. There is partial light. When there is partial light, your decisions have to be more careful. Right? So even as he attaches sunlight to intelligence, he attaches moonlight to doubt. And also he observes, as I said, the Uttarayana and Dakshinayana, he observes that his mood changes with this Uttarayana and Dakshinayana. And this is something which even now we all can observe, isn't it? as the summer months come, our moods become better. As the winter months come, a little bit of gloom. Probably you will not find it so much here, closer to the equator. But as you go north, the difference is very, very drastic, isn't it? Especially this, the day becoming longer and the night becoming shorter, and the night becoming longer and the day becoming shorter, with summer and winter. But 3-4 years back, I had visited London to visit my brother. So it's new for me. I went there. All of the people were so warm. Oh, have a nice day. Whether it's a coffee vendor, or it's a bus conductor. Everybody, oh, have a nice day. Enjoy your stay. So I'd gone to a science center where one elderly person came up to me and he said, "So how are you enjoying your stay in London? What do you feel?" So I said, "Oh, all people seem to be so warm and friendly, and they're all very kind and very social." And he said something which I didn't expect. He said, "Oh, that's because it's summer." He said, "That's because it's summer." If you had come in winter, you wouldn't have had the same opinion. It's not about the culture, it's not about the people, but it's about this relationship between the mind and the movement of the sun. More than anything else, this primitive man was so observant, and not observant only about the phenomenon which was happening outside, but he was keenly connecting it to what was happening within. As Swami would always keep saying, the difference between science and spirituality is this. You only keep going outward, it becomes science. You should always keep seeing what is that outward observation meaning to this inward realm, the inner sky. So this man made this observation. I think 7 or 8 years back, we had one person working in Radio Sai. He was from Lithuania, and he was explaining this. Lithuania is further north than European countries like UK, right? And I had a friend who was doing his research in Helsinki in Finland, where during winter, and I'm sure most of you will know it yourself, you don't need me to tell you, they would have 3 months, 2 months of darkness. The sun doesn't rise at all. Or even if it rises, before it can rise, it's down. It's a beautiful joke somebody was saying. There's this Indian guy who goes to London, he just wants to look around. It's all gloomy all the time, it's either raining or it's cloudy, and it's cold, it's windy. So he looks at one local man and he says, "Don't you ever have summer here?" The local man said, "Yes, we do. Last year it was on a Wednesday." Right? Because with the change in the environment around, your mind starts changing. And this person from Lithuania, he was saying that during those 2-3 months when the winter is on, when there's hardly any daylight, he says the economy starts dipping because people lose their productivity. They don't have the drive to work, they work lesser hours, they sleep more. The number of people who go to psychiatrists increase because of depression cases. It's because there is a connection between what is happening within and what is happening in the skies thousands and thousands of miles away. And the primitive man, the early man, made this connection. And so he decided, if you want to do something good, do it when the sun is going northward. Because at that time, your mind is clear. You make right decisions. You make precise choices. It's not superstition, right? It's not superstition. Probably his understanding was very simple, but there was logic in his understanding. So he says that if you want to do anything, start any business, you want to do any transaction, you want to choose a bride for your son, you want to choose a bridegroom for your daughter, make all these decisions which need sensible thinking. Do it on Uttarayanam, when your thinking is clear. And Swami would say that in the past, all journeys used to take place only in the Uttarayanam. And if anybody had the necessity to travel when the sun is going southward, they would have an elaborate puja they had to do and ritualistic worship. So this comes from this idea that as the sun moves northward, my mind seems to be thinking more clearly, my discrimination seems to be upbeat, right? So this was one of the observations that he made. What is the role of Dakshinayana? As I said, as we go to Dakshinayana or the winter months, the nights are longer. And when the nights are longer, you have the company of the moon. And as he is seeing the correlation between his thinking or his discrimination and the sun, he is also seeing that his mind seems to be a little wavering as it comes to the faces of the moon changing. Right? The moon's faces change and his moods also change. So he realizes that there is a direct connection between the moon and the mind too. Alright, all of this is established. Now another observation that he makes. He takes a seed. He puts it in the earth. Gives it some water. And that seed which was so small now becomes a tree which is so large. And not only does it become so large, but it gives thousands of such seeds. So now he begins to question what makes this small entity grow into a gigantic tree. And again, he sees that the sun's rays seem to be having a very, very important role to play in this process. Yes, the earth is important. Yes, the water is important. But with study, he sees that the sun seems to be very, very important. The most important thing is the sun. And similarly, just as the seed is growing, he sees that even he is growing. He was a tiny infant, which was probably 1.5 feet long. And suddenly he's become this man, who's 5.5, 6 feet tall. And how does he grow? By eating food. By ingesting these plants, and later of course the animals. In other words, he's filling his body with energy from this sun. So he is relating his growth to the energy that he is drawing from the sun. And Swami would say that the first problem that man had, what was the first problem that man had that he had to find a solution for? It was hunger. Right? Swami said, moment the umbilical cord is cut, the body starts feeling hungry. So the first problem, the first crisis that the man faced was this problem of hunger, and the solution for that hunger was he coming up with techniques of agriculture. So the first problem was hunger, the first solution was his ability to grow. So who was aiding him in this first solution? It was the sun. Right? So all of this is leading him to worship the sun more and more. So the primitive worshipper looked at the sun, he says, this sun is choosing when I grow old. The sun is choosing when I am bright, when I am cheerful, it's choosing when I am gloomy. The sun seems to be deciding when my food will grow. The sun seems to be deciding how I will grow. So all of this added together, and then there is this one sun in the sky. He starts worshipping the sun. But this is the primitive man, right? But with time, he realizes that the sun is only a representation. The moon is only a representation. He starts studying the sun and the moon. One of the things which he comes up with is, why do we worship the sun? I remember one of my teachers in college asking this question. We all chant the Gayatri Mantra. Right? We all chant the Gayatri Mantra, and the Gayatri Mantra is supposed to be a means of worshipping the sun. That's why we have that last line in the Gayatri Mantra where we say, Dhiyo Yona Prachodayat. Right? As I said, he drew a connection between the sun, the ability of the sun to brighten your path, and that enabling you to choose, and that choice is made by the intellect, so there's a connection between the sun and the intellect. So that verse ends with Dhiyo Yona Prachodayat. It's a prayer to the sun to illumine our intellect. Dhi is intellect, Prachodayat, enlighten me. So this teacher in college was asking all of us at class, when the Gayatri Mantra is supposed to be a worship of the sun god, why do we always associate Gayatri as a feminine form? We also have Gayatri Mata. Gayatri Mata and Gayatri Mantra is meant to be for sun. How is it related? The explanation he gave was this, and it was very beautiful. He said, what gives glory to the sun? It is the energy, right? All the time we are talking about is energy. It's the energy which gives glory to the sun, and that energy in Sanskrit we call Shakti. And Shakti is always feminine. So this man who is observing all of this, he realized that this sun is not an entity of its own. It has been created. I'm sure with the improvement in astronomical studies, he realized that sun is one of the many stars. The stars that he sees in the sky are just distant, but they are as much brilliant as the sun. So he realizes that somebody has created this entity called the sun so that all of these processes can happen. So he says that there is one who is behind the sun, who is the creator of the sun, and he gives him a name, right? You need names to represent people. He says Prajapati. He gives the name Prajapati, and this is a name you would see often coming in the Vedas and the Upanishads. Literally meaning Prajapati means the ruler of the people. So he says this Prajapati has created the sun, and why has he created the sun? He has created the sun so that it can give out energy. And this energy will fill empty bodies to make them alive. So who made the empty bodies? It's again the same Prajapati. And that's how the Vedic knowledge starts. They say, here is this Prajapati, the divine, the supreme. He creates two entities. Prana and Prani. Right? Prana is the energy. Prani is the inert object which carries this energy. The living beings, Prani literally translated means living beings. So Prana is the energy and Prani is the inert being which becomes conscious because of this entry of this Prana. See how beautifully he is growing in his understanding. And Swami says in that discourse very beautifully, all through this, he constantly keeps telling himself that this may be true, this may not be true. Because it is that humility which is enabling him to understand. He says, I'm drawing conclusions, but I'm not sure. Maybe, may not be. So he says that there is this divine entity which has created prana and prani. And this concept of the prana is essential in all of the other scriptures which followed. Your Ayurveda, your yoga, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, the studies of the different aspects of the body. All of this is based on this concept that this body is inert and it is filled by this energy which comes from the sun. And now when I say sun, it is not the sun which is shining now. Now when I say sun, it is the source. Right? It is the source. The sun is only a physical representation of the source. So already man has moved away from worshipping the sun and the moon. Still he is probably, to confuse us, he has retained the names. Because that's what we will see, that as you go through the Upanishads are supposed to be the refined aspect of the Vedas. The definitions of the sun and the moon changes. The definitions of Uttarayana and Dakshinayana changes. The definition of Indra, Vayu, Varuna, all of these changes. As you go to the advanced aspects of Vedanta. So now he says that this source is giving me the energy. And in that discourse, Swami beautifully describes the different names man gives God. And what is the significance of each of these names. Now the sun's energy is universal, right? It goes everywhere. Even when it is not shining, it is actually creating something or the other. So this energy which is universal is given the name Vishnu. Vishnu actually means all pervasive. If you go into mythology, you would probably not get as confused as I am, but you will get confused. Because the stories are so very confusing. We talk of one sun in the sky, they talk of 12 Adityas, 12 suns. And they say the sun which is actually sustaining this earth is Lord Vishnu. You will wonder, where is Vishnu? But sun god is a different deity. How is Vishnu sun god? But it all has this inner meaning which probably will not come unless we stop and say that definitely those people who wrote all this are wiser than me. Right? Unless that faith is there, probably we will not go into it at all. We will say that we are wiser than them. But this is the meaning of all of this. He says the sun which sustains us, sustains everything around. And as Swami would say many times, the sun does not discriminate between a good man and a bad man, and a good plant and a bad plant, a poisonous plant and a nutritious plant. It gives energy to everybody. It's universal. It gives everybody. So that deity which gives energy is called Vishnu. And that prana is believed to enter the body. And this inert body suddenly becomes active. There are these two very beautiful Sanskrit words they use, mrinmaya and chinmaya. right? Mrinmaya means made out of sand, made out of earth. This body, which is actually made out of earth, which is made out of dust, becomes conscious when this prana enters this body. When a person dies, what leaves? It's one of the questions which will many times come in the Upanishads, where the disciples will come and ask the master, when a man dies, what leaves? And in one of Swami's Vahini, Swami says, a very beautiful point, it was so very profound, it was, Swami says, there is God even in a dead body. How profound is that? There is God even in a dead body. We think, Swami says, I am God, you are also God, so there is God in me. When I die, the God moves out. Swami says, no, God does not move out because God is everywhere. There is God even in a dead body, Swami says in, I think, Prashnotra Vahini, he says. There is God even in a dead body. So what comes in and what goes out? What moves into a body when there is a fetus growing in the womb? Till a certain point, it is lifeless. Suddenly it comes alive. It becomes a boy or a girl, grows up, and one fine day drops dead. So what came in and what went out? The Vedas say the prana comes in and the prana goes out. The energy from the source comes in, and that energy, when it ebbs out of this body, the body falls. It's an interesting science fact that I was reading. You know, in our gut, in the body, there are these millions and millions of bacteria. We don't realize. And these bacteria actually help us to digest the food. Imagine for 70 years, 80 years we are living, this bacteria is being a good friend to us, digesting the food that we are throwing into the gut. And when we die, what happens? The same bacteria starts eating the body. The same bacteria eats the body from inside, and that's how the body decomposes. Of course, there is other forces from outside too. What makes this change? At one point, suddenly, even the bacteria in the body goes haywire. What changes everything? And the Vedas say the prana comes in and the prana goes out. And physically, this prana seems to go into the body and do magic inside. Right? They say this prana is actually one, but when it goes into the body, it takes different functions. It takes five functions to be precise, as they say. Prana, which is the breathing. Right? The main prana is what keeps the heart beating, the breath up and down, the blood oxygenated, you live. That is the main prana. There are four other pranas or four other functions that this same prana takes. Apana, Vyana, Udana and Samana. Makes you wonder, you know, how did they come up with all of these? How did they understand all of these? I mean, one thing is probably it's insight. Probably it's a divine inspiration. But it is humble observation. More than anything else, these people who sat and observed themselves so very keenly and humbly. So what are all these pranas? Each of these have a function in the body. Like Samana is supposed to be the digestive power. The Vyana is supposed to be the energy, what we call the nadis and the spinal column. That which energizes the whole body. You have an energy column. Swami says that 72,000 nadis in the body. And this Vyana is like zipping through all of these nadis, and that's how you're alive. And then Swami says there's the apana, which helps you excrete. It is the outward moving prana. And then you have the udana. Udana is which I am using to communicate to all of you, which enables you to speak, which is an upward moving air. And in yogic practices, you know, it all looks like magic, but they actually mastered all of these pranas. If you have gained mastery over the samana prana, you can conquer hunger. You can live for years and years without food. And they say if you conquer this udana, which is allowing you to speak, which is allowing you to actually walk. If I jump, if I'm able to walk. So they say if you're able to have complete control over this udana prana, you can float. Right? That's something which we read about the yogis. They used to levitate. It was actually some form of science where they got mastery over this udana prana. So all of these things, and similarly Vyana, where you have ability to cure yourself. the moment you have mastery over the Vyana Prana. And all of this comes from that initial prana which comes from the source. So it comes in, it animates you. And then Swami says that it has one or two other functions too, all these pranas. And probably we'll just stick to one prana which Swami speaks about. This prana which I said about udana, which we use for speech. Apart from enabling us to speak, it enables us to belch. Swami says that's also one of the things. It enables us to vomit. It enables us to sneeze. The other thing this udana prana does is, it carries all our actions. Throughout life, when we do good actions, bad actions, harmful actions, helpful actions, this udana prana is the accountant. Notes down everything. And when the prana leaves the body, they say that it is this udana prana which has an account of all the good and bad that you've done. And Swami says that when you die, don't think it's like when you get into a bus, whichever seat is empty, you go and sit. You don't get into a body like that. Oh, somebody is going to have a baby, let's go and be born there. There's a president of this country who's going to have a kid, so there's a vacancy there, let me go. It's not like that. It is this udana prana which chooses. These are the good things that you've done. These are the bad things you've done. This is the body you deserve. So this prana enters into a body, into a family, into a circumstance which is defined by this udana prana which carries all the good and bad actions. So what does all this have to do with Uttarayana and Dakshinayana? Right? What does all this have to do with Sankranti? Now coming to the Upanishads. The Upanishads also speak about the two journeys, the Uttarayana and the Dakshinayana. What did we start with? The first observation that man made was, sun is going up, sun is coming down in the skies, right? So as the sun is going up, the days are getting longer. I'm able to think clearly. I'm shouting at my wife less. My wife is heckling me less. All of these observations he's making. But the Upanishads say that the Uttarayana that you actually have to think about is not the movement of the sun, but the movement of your life. Starting with the first thing which we said, in the light of the sun, you're able to see more clearly, right? In the darkness of the night, there is more doubt. So when the Upanishad says that you have to take the journey towards the Uttarayana, it says you do more actions which are clearly guided by the conscience, which are clearly guided by the source, the divinity within. The more actions that you do guided by the moonlight, which I said the moonlight has a significance which is similar to the mind. The more you do actions guided by the mind and the needs and the desires of the mind, you are journeying, and that journey is called Dakshinayana. Right? You see the correlation which they've drawn between the Uttarayana and the Dakshinayana. As the sun moves northward, the mind is more clear because it can see better, right? So when you're able to see better, you're making your decisions more clearly, you're making your decisions based on your conscience. That is a sign that your life is actually on the Uttarayana mode. And when you're making decisions based on your mind, you're making it on the basis of the Dakshinayana mode. How does the moon represent the mind? This is a very important point which will explain what is it that we'll have to do. Alright, all this mumbo jumbo is fine, what am I supposed to do? When we first look at the moon is brilliant, the moon is shining. But with observation we realize that the moon does not have light of its own. Right? The moon does not have light of its own. We used to study a concept called, I don't know if I'm getting the term right, it's called albedo. If I'm not wrong, it's an astronomical concept called albedo. The ability of a celestial body to hold back light. If the gravity of that celestial body is very high, it pulls back just like how you throw a ball and it comes back. Even light is drawn back. So the light is never sent out, when the light is never sent out, the body doesn't shine, right? So now when I'm looking at the moon, the moon is reflecting light, so the light is reaching me. If the gravity of the moon is so strong, it will draw all the light and it will not send out light. So they say that as a celestial body, the moon has lesser albedo, so it gives out more light. So all of this has been done by observation. And he sees the moon is not having light of its own. The moon is reflecting the sun's light. So what will happen? More reverence for the sun. You know, I thought there are two entities, the sun and the moon. Now I realize the sun is all powerful. Even the moon's light, the sun is only giving. So there's more reverence for the sun. But what is important is, this moon seems to be having a light of its own. It is not its own light, but it appears to be shedding light. Right? The truth and what appears to be the truth. The sun is truly giving out light, but the moon appears to be giving out light, but it is actually reflecting light. So is the sun bright? Yes. Is the moon bright? Yes. Appearance-wise, both are bright. Brightness is different. That's a different thing. But both are luminescent. But the truth is, one is creating light, one is shining, the other is reflecting. And this creates two concepts which are again very central to the Vedantic philosophy. Satya and Mithya. Right? Two concepts. Satya and Mithya. Where Satya is the truth, Mithya is the apparent truth. It's not lies. Satya's antonym is Asatya. They don't say it's Satya and Asatya. They say Satya and Mithya. Truth and what appears like the truth. And why is the moon related to the mind? They say the mind does not have any ability of its own. The mind only reflects the brilliance of the Atma. Reflects the brilliance of the divinity within. So the mind is also like the moon, and that's why they see that with the changing faces of the moon, there seems to be some changing in the mind also. If you actually see, I don't know whether scientifically it's proven or it's just an observation, especially people who have mental problems. They have instability in the mind. They're in an asylum. They say that you can clearly see a behavioral change as the faces of the moon change. During the darker phases, as they call Krishna Paksha, as the moon is becoming darker and darker, these people become more unmanageable. Or the other way around, I don't know. But there is a correlation between how the mind acts and the moon acts. And that is why in the Vedas, what do they say? These two, Swami would very often quote this. Chaksho Suryo Ajayata, in the Purusha Suktam. The ability to see clearly comes from the sun. Chandrama Manaso Jayata. The ability to think is ruled by the moon. So now in life, bringing this whole thing to life, there are some things which are real, which are the truth. And some other things appear like the truth. And why do they appear like the truth? Because we inject life into them. They don't have meaning of their own. We inject life into them. Simplest thing can you think of? Wealth. What makes a diamond precious? What makes gold precious? What makes a piece of paper precious? I inject value into that. Right? The name and fame that I earn in society. What others think of me. The respect the others give me. Actually, there is no value in it. But I inject value in it, and as much value I inject into it, that much life it has for me. So that is not satya, but that is mithya. So how much of your life is guided by these mithya aspects, and how much of your life is guided by the satya aspect? And Swami would repeatedly say that probably the only sadhana that one has to do is this discrimination of what is satya and what is mithya. What is real, what is unreal. Swami would quote Chanakya, who says, Bhaja nitya anityatam. Bhaja nitya anityatam. distinguish between what is eternal and what is ephemeral, because what is eternal is satyam. What is eternal is the truth. What appears like the truth keeps changing, right? What appears like the truth and changes is the fact. Nobody is saying it's a lie, but it is not something which you can go by. So when you say Dakshinayana and Uttarayana, and Vedanta says that that person who takes the journey of Uttarayana, who's journeying towards the sun or upwards, he lands up in the Surya Loka, the world of the sun. Wow, that would be interesting, right? And the one who follows the mind, the Dakshinayana path, he lands up in the Chandra Loka, the world of the moon. Swami is very quick to point out, it's not that Neil Armstrong followed Dakshinayana and landed up in the moon. Swami says it's not that moon which the Americans and Russians and Chinese and now Indians are trying to land in. That is why long back, we have already crossed this physical entities of the sun, the moon and all of that. We've already crossed. And because an interesting fact is, when is the winter solstice? It's actually on December 21st. The winter solstice, which Sankranti is supposed to mark, is not on January 14th, but it's on December 21st. And now they say that when you study, the real Sankranti was on December 21st, probably in 700 BC or 300 BC, when Indian astronomics was at its best. Now, when you had all of these scientists who were very good at astronomy, at studying the stars and the movement of the moon and all of that, at that time it was fixed that this is Sankranti, which marks the winter solstice. So actually speaking, we have moved away from that idea, but still Swami says Uttarayanam is coming, think like this, do like this, because there is this different Uttarayana which we are supposed to embrace. And when we are concentrating all our actions based on this, probably I'll end with one more reason why Swami says that the sun is very special. Because when the primitive man looked at sun, he found the sun being able to do two things which was very difficult for him. What was it? Immense regularity. Day in and day out, day in and day out, this fellow is rising and setting and rising and setting. He doesn't seem to be tired. Relentless discipline, right? And such discipline is called dharma. The ability to stick to your role untiringly. And he found that this sun god was a representation of that absolute adherence to duty. Whatever happens, one day it's raining, one day it's storm, but still the sun will rise and set, rise and set. I am able to see the sun, I am not able to see the sun, but the sun is relentless in its duty. So the sun represented duty. And the more he studied the sun, he realized that the sun, as Swami would say, is burning itself to give out energy. And what does that represent? It represents sacrifice. So Swami would say, during Sankranti, when you look at the sun, when you worship the sun, you're worshipping these two qualities of your ability to do your duty and to sacrifice. And that's why the Vedas, they say, there is this beautiful verse which Swami has quoted n number of times. Na karmana na prajaya na dhanena thyage naike amrtatva manashuhu. It is not through action. It is not through having children. Because there is this belief in Indian system that the children do ceremonies for you after you are dead to ensure that you get onto the rocket and reach the heaven. It's not through prajaya. It is not through the wealth that you earn. And when we say wealth, the wealth of materials and the wealth of knowledge. Na karmana, na prajaya, na dhanena. Thyage naike amrtatva manashu. It is only through sacrifice. And when the Upanishad says that you will reach the loka of the sun, the loka of the moon, what they mean is, what we call heaven, the Chandra Loka is actually what we call heaven. And Swami says, reaching Chandra Loka is nothing great. When you reach Chandra Loka, what will you do? It's like being elected to the parliament. After 5 years, you have to come back. But if you're a good parliamentarian, after 5 years, you're supposed to give up all that. Right? But that's what happens. Swami says that when you, within this world, do good actions, nothing, you don't cheat anybody, you do good actions, you do good business, you do good transactions, What are you doing? You're actually satisfying your mind's desires through dharmic means, through righteous means. You're not doing something which is wrong, you're doing something which is right. But that is not good enough, Swami says. Because when you're doing all of this, you're still operating within the mind. My mind wants me to become a PhD, my mind wants me to become a scientist, my mind wants me to become a collector, or whatever. Why? Because there is a respect in society for that. There is a certain thing I can achieve with that. And who gives importance to that? It's I who give importance to that. It is not brilliant of its own. It's not important of its own. It's important because I give importance to that. And anything which gains importance because I give importance to it is like the moon reflecting the rays of the sun. So it is not enough doing what is right. It is not enough doing things in the right manner. That will only take you to this temporary heaven, Swami says, the Chandraloka. And after you finish all of that, you have to come back. And who takes care of that? This Udana. And see this beauty of mythology, how beautifully they make it. They make sun an entity. They gave him a name, Surya. In fact, they gave him number of names. In school, when we study Sanskrit, they tell us that if there is one entity which has many names in Sanskrit, that is sun. So many names, I think 24, 200, whatever it is. That many names for this one entity called the sun. So they make him a deity. They give him an appearance. How do they do? He is drawn by a chariot with 7 horses. What are the 7 horses? The 7 colors of the rainbow. All representation. And then they say, he has 2 wives. And the wives give children, and each one of them have a significance. And 2 of them probably we'll just deal with, Yama and Shani. Right? These are 2 sons of, according to mythology, the 2 sons of the sun god. Yama is supposed to be the lord of death. Shani is supposed to be the lord who troubles you when you're alive, technically. But what they say is, these 2 play an interesting role. What are the roles they play? Yama is called Dharma Raja, who dispenses what is your right after your death. Shani is one who dispenses what you deserve, good or bad, when you're alive. So these are nothing but 2 concepts which dispense your reaction to your actions, good and bad, when you're alive and after you're dead. And they say they are children of sun god. So if you're only pleasing within this, you'll only go till the moon. No, you have to go till the sun. Because why? As Swami says, this prana is like, it's endless. Today it's in this body, tomorrow I die, it gets into another body, that body dies, it gets into another body. When will this journey stop? It is only when this prana goes and merges into its source. And how will it merge into its source? It has to travel to the Surya Loka. How will it travel to the Surya Loka? It has to embark upon this journey called Uttarayana. And how will it embark on this journey called Uttarayana? It is through Dharma and Tyaga. That's why in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the 18th chapter, which is supposed to be the summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks a very beautiful question. He says, Krishna, what is the difference between a sannyasi and a tyagi? What is the difference between sannyasa and tyaga? What is the difference between renunciation and sacrifice? A very, very deep and profound question. And Krishna says, if you renounce your duty, you renounce all your duties. I'm so-and-so's son, I'm so-and-so's husband, I'm so-and-so's... You leave all that, take sannyasa. If you renounce your duty, you become a sannyasi. If you do your duty and you renounce the benefits you will get out of it, you become a tyagi. Right? He says, karma tyaga makes you a sannyasi or a renunciant. Karma phala tyaga makes you a tyagi. And Krishna says, like how Swami will beautifully say, in my humble opinion, na uttesamlo, Swami would say. Krishna says in the same manner, in my opinion, a tyagi is better than a sannyasi. The one who is able to do the action and give up the results. And that's why the same verse which I quoted, na karmana, na prajaya, na dane, na tyage, na ike, Swami gives a beautiful twist to that shloka. He says, na karmana, it's not through actions, but karma tyaga. Right? He takes the tyaga and puts it along with karma. He says, not through karma, but karma tyaga. With this, do your action and then sacrifice. Karma tyaga. Prajena tyaga, Swami says. It is not through children and progeny, but caring for your children and progeny with a sense of detachment. With a sense of trusteeship. And finally he says, dhanena tyaga. It is not through earning wealth, but after having the wealth, the ability to be not attached to the wealth. The ability to share, give it away. And what does all of this have to do with Sankranti? And Swami says, the meaning of the word Sankranti is, Samyak Kranti Iti Sankranti, Swami would say. The good change. Kranti means change, revolution. Sankranti is the good change. The day when the good change happens, the Uttarayanam begins. How subtle is that? How subtle is that? On the day in your life when you choose this Sankranti to happen, you say, I am not interested just to get worldly benefits. I am not interested in worldly posts and worldly fame and worldly wealth. I want that ultimate. The day you decide, that day becomes Sankranti. And when that Sankranti comes, what happens? The Uttarayana begins. Your journey northward begins. And when your journey northward begins, your destination is the source. And what does that require? It requires all of this. Do, but be detached. Act, but don't act with the results in your mind. And that was why this festival was so very important. And how very fortunate we are to have celebrated this festival for so many years, to be celebrating this festival for so many years in Swami's presence, to be here at this point in time. Because there are three things. Physically, it does matter, right? It does matter. It doesn't mean, okay, all of this is only subtle, we'll forget all of that. Now coming back to the same story, why did Swami follow Rahu Kalam? Because yes, physically there is a relation between Rahu Kalam and my mind. There is a relationship between the sunrise and sunset and the sun moving upward and sun moving downward with my mind. As I said, there is a relationship. But that is only a physical relationship. See, within this, let us say tomorrow I'm starting a business. So I say tomorrow Rahu Kalam is at this time, I will start at this time. So I am following Rahu Kalam, but am I not still following the desires of my mind? I only want mind's benefits. So I am following the physical attributes of this ritual, but the subtler aspects, the spiritual aspects, I am missing out. So yes, you have to an extent follow it physically and look deeper. And finally, that should define our spiritual journey. And finally, to end with, as Swami would say, don't wait till January 14th for Sankranti. Swami would say, if you decide today is a Sankranti, the moment you make up your mind is the day of Sankranti. So with that thought, with humble pranams to Swami and for this opportunity, thank you all for your very, very patient listening. I offer this humble talk at Swami's Lotus Suite.
Jai Sai Ram.